All right, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our 1030 docket. We will proceed through both of them, the first one being Brazil versus Hillman, and the second one, Ruiz versus Ruiz. And I believe everybody's checked in with the clerk, and so if the clerk will announce counsel, who'll be arguing today. All right, Mr. Leonard.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is John Leonard, and I represent Dr. Clark Brazel, and he is a physician in Wichita Falls, Texas. Brendan Harville will represent Merida Roberts Hillman. I'll try to remember to refer her to as Ms. Roberts, and Ms. Roberts is the guardian of the person in the estate of the ward, Jenny Stokes, and I'll refer to her as Ms. Stokes. Basically, this case involves tort claims against Dr. Brazel and others. These claims arise from the fact that Ms. Hillman, Ms. Roberts, claims that at the time that certain transactions were entered into by Ms. Stokes, she was incompetent. There are several facts that are necessary in this case. One, Dr. Brazel's only relationship with Ms. Stokes was that as a physician. He only had contact with her either for medical office visits or in the hospital. He did not have any socialization with her outside of those transactions or meetings. The second part is that he did treat her for a long period of time, which brings us to the year of 2007. 2007 is the year when the transactions occurred of which Ms. Roberts complains. In 2007, Ms. Stokes created and then terminated a living trust. She also executed various powers of attorney and transfers of property and made various transfers of property. None of these transfers went to Dr. Brazel. The reason that it's so important that at this time period that Ms. Stokes is incompetent is that if she's competent, she may have made a bad business deal, but that doesn't mean it can be undone in the future. During 2007, Dr. Brazel said that she was competent to conduct her business. In addition to Dr. Brazel, Dr. Del Rio, Dr. John, and Dr. Sabine also said that she was competent to conduct business.
Excuse me, so was there a competency hearing in 2007?
There was no competency hearing. This was as a result of, one, Dr. Brazel looking at his client and saying, yes, you can still conduct business. Then he sent her to, Dr. Del Rio and Dr. Sabine for them to give a second opinion to make sure he was correct. But he did interview her, talk to her, and came up with the diagnosis or the
And were one of those two other physicians that he referred her to, were they neurologists, or did they have some specialty other than being a general practitioner?
Neither one of those are general practitioners. I can't remember exactly what Dr. Del Rio is. Dr. Sabine is a PhD with psychology as his main background, and then Dr. John is a neurologist.
Okay, thank you.
After 2007, the transfers had been made. In 2009, Ms. Roberts gets her ward, Ms. Stokes, and takes her to Denton. On the way, they stop at Dr. Clayton's office, and she conducts an interview with her to determine whether or not she's competent or incompetent. in 2009, I believe, and that's March of 2009, she determines that she's incompetent at that time. Up until February of 2009, Dr. Brazel had still continued to treat her. In 2010, Ms. Roberts had commenced a grievance against Michael Payne. Mr. Payne was the attorney that represented Ms. Stokes. In regard to that grievance procedure, Dr. Brazel wrote a letter to the state bar that set forth his statement of facts as to what transpired. It wasn't to relieve anybody from liability. Also, the Ms. Roberts has argued that that letter hurt her client. Now, the letter did not take away from her client any ability to sue Mr. Payne for any of the damages she alleged she suffered. Whether or not whatever action the state bar took, she still had the civil suit that had to be brought. Then going into whether or not this is a claim, there never was an expert report prepared or filed. In the fall of 2013, Ms. Roberts realized that there would be some expert testimony that would be necessary. At that point in time, she amended her responses to disclosure and added Dr. Clayton, stating that Dr. Clayton would find that Ms. Stokes was incompetent in 2007, which would directly conflict with the findings of four doctors. Ms. Roberts has argued, well, we're not talking about the care that was given by Dr. Brazel, but just the results. They also complained that he stepped out of his shoes as her physician in some of the manners in which he treated her or had to discuss matters with other people. Now then, the first prong of the claim for a health care liability claim is one, you have to be a health care provider or physician. No one has argued that Dr. Brazel's not a physician. That brings us to the second point, which is whether or not there's been a deviation from the standard of care. For treatment, lack of treatment, or other claim departures from accepted standards of medical care, health care, or safety, or administrative matters. So in this instance, they have complained, one, that Dr. Brazel came out and said that she was competent when she was incompetent. Well, that's a claim concerning the treatment and the diagnosis and whether or not he deviated from the acceptable standards of care. Two, they complained that he stepped out of his shoes. Well, to be able to show that you stepped out of your shoes, you're going to have to show that there was no deviation from the standard of care if you're arguing that it's not a health care liability claim. But in this instance, they've pled that he did step out, so that's showing a deviation from the standard of care. The third basics of their claim has to do with the fact that they're claiming that he disclosed information to other people that shouldn't have received it. The cases have held that violations of a patient's right of privacy, whether it be HIPAA or the state law, is a violation of or creates a health care liability claim. The plaintiffs, Ms. Roberts, argued that the 2010 letter has nothing to do with Dr. Brazel being Ms. Stokes' physician because it occurred after the physician-client relationship had terminated. However, the administrative requirements of a doctor to continue to keep their patients' information privileged remains whether or not they're in active relationship with each other. And the case law has held that, and we've cited that in our brief. Consequently, we believe the second prong has been addressed and answered. Now, once you get the first and second prong addressed and answered, a rebuttable presumption arises that it is a health care claim. At that point in time, the person who's contesting that it is not a health care liability claim has to bring in some evidence that it's not. Now, in this case, Ms. Roberts did not present any evidence. As we've set forth in the brief, Judge Robinson didn't ask for any evidence. She just ruled after opening statements had been made. However, since this is a trial de novo on this issue, they still had to put something into the record to show that this was not a health care liability claim. We believe that there's nothing there, and so the presumption was not rebutted. The third prong is that the damages are related to the actions, inactions of which the person complains. In this action, they're saying that but for Dr. Brazel finding her competent, she would not have suffered the damages that have occurred to her, because if he had found her incompetent, somebody could have been either immediately appointed to take care of her, or they would have the evidence to show that the dissolution of the trust was improper, the transfers of property were improper, all of those actions of which they allege shouldn't have happened. So we have a direct nexus between his actions and their complaints. Now then, they argue that we're not asking for personal injury. Well, the act covers economic and non-economic damages and damages that arise as a result of tort or contract, which covers all damages that people can incur. In that instance, they've tried to say, well, we're only talking about property damage because we're talking about the property that she lost as a result of the actions that people have taken. Well, to me, that's just a measure of the damages. The courts are not bound by the pleadings. They're not bound by the type of damages asked. They're to look at the gravamen of the suit and see, does this involve the treatment between a health care provider and a patient? And in this instance, we say that everything is involved there. However they want to measure their damages is fine. Cases have already held that you can't write in to the damages bodily injury. And we've cited those in the brief. Consequently, we believe even if you go to the third prong, we've proven that this is a health care liability case. One of the things we've also asked for is attorney's fees. In that regard, we presented evidence at the trial court, and even though it was by an offer of proof, we believe that we are entitled to the attorney's fees as a matter of law, and that's because as a matter of law, there was no evidence that to contradict what we requested. It would be similar to a person doing a summary judgment action and putting in their request for attorney's fees and that being upheld on appeal unless the other side had introduced evidence sufficient to raise a doubt as to the propriety of the attorney's fees requested.
So there was an actual hearing on your client's motion to dismiss?
There was an actual hearing date set, and we argued our positions to the judge, but we were not able to present the evidence except by offer.
Okay. The judge didn't say we're not taking any evidence on this case. The judge just ruled after the oral arguments were completed.
That's correct, and then I asked immediately to be able to make an offer of proof.
Which you did in the bill of review.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do we get around the holding of this court in the Kaufman case. I read what you put in your brief. You read the case, you read what I said in dissent. However, that precedential holding states in very clear terms that the maintaining of records is a part of the presentation of care, and there's no doubt there was care, even if it was 207 and prior. And there's no doubt that there was contact and in which there was disclosure. I don't see how that we can get to the point. I mean, I understand that your position, this is definitely a health care claim. And it appears to me that that's what the opinion in Kaufman says. And so when you get back to this court's precedent, it's very strong in the Kaufman case that it controls this case.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's what we've said, that this is a health care liability case, because they're arguing that there is disclosure of confidential information, and that was all related and came from the her position as being Dr. Brazel's patient. Once it's determined that this is a health care liability claim, then they had, from the date that Dr. Brazel filed his answer, 120 days in which to file their expert report.
And if I understand that. I guess I'm trying to get back to, you know, my dissenting opinion in the other case came about as a result of the statement that I quoted in authority that simply seemed to leave out a disclosure to the hospital in that case, I mean by the hospital in that case, and here we're dealing with a physician. There's really not much difference in the maintaining of records requirement, and it's, if anything, it's probably more direct to the physician than it is the hospital, although that'd be splitting a very fine hair. And so it appears to me that the dilemma that we're in here is that the causes of action are so different as what, like the court discussed in the Houston court of the Shanti case, that this is just one of those places where there needs to be a line drawn that this is not a health care liability claim, being on the other side. And so precedent carries us as far as precedent carries us, and it appears that the Kaufman case is in your favor. However, I wonder if the further development of the aspect of what is in fact a healthcare claim by the succeeding opinions gives some credence to the drawing of a line, at this case.
I understand then your dilemma on that, but I believe that the Supreme Court cases that have come down have said that you look at whether or not the actual matter is involved with the health care that was provided, whether it be diagnosis, treatment, deviation from standards of care, and that's what you look at. And in this case, we believe all of that happened. This isn't where you would have a physician and a patient that, say, form a partnership and then have a dispute over the partnership. Yes, you have a physician-patient relationship, but the complaint has nothing to do with what the doctor did as a doctor. In this case, their entire suit is based upon Dr. Brazel's actions as either a doctor or stepping out of his shoes, but still related to Ms. Stokes's health care. I mean, you've got direct on there that they say that she was competent when Dr. Brazel found her incompetent. They, as we've cited in the brief, they said that their claim against Dr. Brazel, and this is Ms. Roberts, claim against Dr. Brazel is negligence, and then she also says it's a breach of a fiduciary duty between a patient and a physician, and that's the only duty. So with the facts that are there and what they've actually pled and asked for, we don't get Dr. Brazel outside of being a doctor.
All right. Thank you for answering.
I have a question. So you're saying if Dr. Brazel had been an oncologist and had discovered that this woman had a very short time to live and had given her a clean bill of health and had taken out an insurance policy on her. And when she died, collected on the insurance policy, that would be a health care claim?
Well, that goes to the act of whether, well, they're not making a complaint about whether or not he found or didn't find, or whether or not he advised her as her physician. This is a totally separate act because that has nothing to do with the health care, lack of health care, or standards. Now, there are some cases that go, yes, you may not have to.
Wait,
have.
What has nothing to do with health care, lack of health care, or standards? Not giving her a clean bill of health when he knows she's dying of cancer?
Well, that is a health care claim if they want to bring a health care claim negligence.
They want to bring a claim because because he took out an insurance policy on her for a large amount of money, collected the insurance, thereby defrauding, I guess, the insurance company, and also there would be the silence as far as his diagnosis. So would that be exclusively a health care claim, or would it be a mixed claim? Would the insurance company have a claim? Would the family have a claim?
In that instance, since there's the issue of whether or not there's a proper diagnosis and whether or not his actions afterwards were proper, I believe you're going to have the 120-day expert report. Just because you have to have an expert report doesn't mean that the expert testimony is necessary to prove your damages.
So the insurance company has to have an expert report in order to sue this doctor for defrauding him.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
No, I'm saying who all has to have the expert report? The patient?
The
insurance company? Who?
Well, there are cases that are close to that where insurance companies have sued doctors and medical clinics, and they've sued for breach of contract. And the courts specifically held in those two cases that we are saying that their causes of action exist outside of a health care liability claim because they're not using subrogation. In this instance, if the insurance company has a cause of action for breach of contract or fraud directly of their own, then they could sue directly. However, if their cause of action is somehow related to or based on the violation of their insured's rights, then it does become a health care liability claim under the reading of those cases, and they would need to have an expert report. And as I said, just because you have the expert report doesn't mean that that's going to be necessary for the proof of damages.
So I can know somebody is dying of cancer, take out an insurance policy on them, and keep my mouth shut and fill out whatever forms without indicating my knowledge. And the insurance company can go directly after me. But if I'm a doctor and I do exactly the same thing, then they've got to have a doctor's report. An expert's report?
No, what I was saying on there is if they're using some form of subrogation, some form of their insured's rights.
No, I'm not subrogation, just straight
if it's fraud. Just straight contract between the insurance company and the reason the courts went off on this is that the insurance company on its own has never asked for health care to it from this doctor. So the insurance company in these cases does not meet the definition of claimant under the Health Care Liability Act. And that's what the cases have held. If it's totally owned, has nothing to do with any type of subrogation claim, then the insurance company and the doctor have a suit. because it's not the fact that a person's a doctor. It's the fact of whether or not the suit relates to or is involved with the health care he provided, the diagnosis the doctor provided, disclosure of information the doctor did. All of those are health care liability claims.
Financial advice, is that a health care claim?
Well, it depends upon how you're saying it, but in this instance, in this case, they're saying that there was information given that you may or may not want to do things. What they're saying is that you shouldn't say that, that a reasonable doctor wouldn't say that. Consequently, that's a deviation from the standards of medical care. There was a case where a person had asked that they not have general anesthesia. Then they sued the doctor because they did get general anesthesia, and they said, well, now that's a breach of contract and agreement, so we don't need any.
You're equating anesthesia with financial advice?
I'm equating it not with financial advice, but whether or not something arose in the context of health care and health care being given.
If a doctor scams somebody, you've got to get a medical, you've got to get the expert's report. If I scam somebody, you just take me straight to court.
If a person's not a physician, then the health care or a health care provider, then the act does not apply and its requirements don't apply. Okay. Now, sorry, I forgot what I was saying.
You answered my question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Leonard. And we did go over quite a bit. So let's add 3 minutes to the appellee's time, should they need that, or we might need it. All right. Mr. Harville, am I saying your last name correctly?
Harville.
Harville, okay.
May it please the court. Brendan Harvell, here with Kevin Spencer. We represent Marita J. Roberts Hillman as guardian of the estate of Jenny M. Stokes, an incapacitated person. I have a tendency to talk a little fast, so if I'm going a little too fast, please interrupt me and let me know. Not everything a doctor does is a health care liability claim, and doctors are not immune for acts which violate the law. One of the things that I want to start off by talking about is that although the Texas Medical Liability Act evidences an intent by the legislature to give an expansive application, courts must be equally careful not to extend Chapter 74's bounds beyond its reach beyond its stated bounds. Some instances, the only possible relationship between the conduct underlining a claim and the rendition of medical services or healthcare will be the healthcare setting or the physical location of where the conduct occurred, or the defendant's status as a doctor, or both, which I think clearly is applicable to this case for many reasons. I just want to go through appellant's argument a little bit and just talk in general about why this is not a healthcare liability claim. The Texas Supreme Court has provided that a definition of a healthcare liability claim consists of three components, which counsel had gone over. But just to restate, the first is that a physician or healthcare provider must be named as a defendant, which is not something that we dispute. Clearly, Dr. Brazil is a physician, he's a doctor, and that's not something that we dispute. The other two components are the ones that are disputed, the first being that the cause of action is for treatment, lack of treatment, or other claim departure from accepted standards of medical care, health care, or safety, or professional or administrative services directly related to health care. But one thing I want to talk about is that in the briefs, your honors are well aware that the assertion by appellant is that we've asserted claims against Dr. Brazil on the basis that he was negligent in his failure to properly diagnose or care for Jeannie M. Stokes. We completely dispute that. And in fact, that's not the case. And What we have done and the claims that we have asserted against Dr. Brazil solely relate to what he was doing with the other defendants. And we complain of specific factual circumstances regarding his knowledge of and participation in this concerted effort or scheme with defendant Michael Payne, his friend, who he had prior dealings with, who had represented him back in the 90s in a divorce and who had done an excellent job for him, and possibly some of these other defendants, knowing of Jeannie's issues that she had as far as a weakened state of mind, including suffering from periods of confusion and dementia and depression, and had a general inability to make rational judgments. And he participated in this scheme or this effort to defraud her and have her enter into transactions at a time when she lacked the requisite mental capacity or was influenced to sign them. And that's what our claims relate to. One thing that I do want to point out right away is that the appellant has asserted that he had diagnosed her as competent. Well, he doesn't do any formal competency or neurological testing. And in fact, when he saw that she was having issues, he sent her out to two separate doctors to have testing done. Now, we haven't alleged any claims against either one of those doctors for improperly diagnosing her or for their services related to the testing that was done, because that's not the basis of our claims against Dr. Brazil. Instead, it solely relates to his conduct with defendant Michael Payne and possibly these other defendants in this scheme to defraud, his knowing participation and the efforts he took to not only participate in, but to protect those individuals, specifically Michael Payne. Now, the second prong, and appellant had stated that there's three main bases, and that was that complained that Dr. Brazil has said she was competent and he deviated from same, which I just addressed, and that's not the case. The second is that he stepped out of his shoes, and that necessarily involves a deviation from the standard of care. Well, stepped out of his shoes is just an artful term of saying that he wasn't acting as her physician, because what he was doing was that he was talking with defendant Michael Payne during her care, and then after her care had ended, a year and a half after, his friend Michael Payne calls up and says, hey, look, I might be in some trouble. I've got this grievance that's filed against me. Help me out. I need you to write a letter. So what does Dr. Brazil do? He writes a letter in support, full support of defendant Michael Payne, saying that he doesn't think he did anything wrong. He doesn't have any evidence of his wrongdoing. And he did that solely for the purposes of helping out his friend, defendant Michael Payne. It was in no furtherance of her care. It was in no way related to her care. In fact, it was a year and a half after her care had ended, which I'll address as it relates to the third prong in just a minute.
But didn't the letter include statements as to Dr. Brazil's belief that she was competent at the time he was treating her?
Right. But what we've alleged is that that letter was not written for the purposes of her medical care or her treatment during the course of her treatment. Instead, what it was written for a year and a half after this treatment was ended was solely for the purposes of helping Michael Payne out, and in no way related to her services, and to his services as her doctor. Instead, the sole purpose of that letter was to protect and help out his friend, which is signifies and exemplifies the steps he took in this participation and in this scheme to defraud. The specific allegations complained of against Michael Payne and having her enter into this fee agreement and then getting her to execute transactions at a time when she had a weakened state of mind, he went to help him in protecting that and help him shield his essential liability, was what would be asserted as far as our allegations. As far as the rebuttable presumption that counsel alluded to is created or is established once those first two elements have met, well, we clearly dispute the second prong, so we don't think that any rebuttable presumption applies. But even if it does, the court in the case in which that he cited this rebuttable presumption quickly pointed out and clarified that this presumption is necessarily rebuttable. And again, and going back to my quote, in some instances, the only possible relationship between the conduct underlying a claim and the rendition of medical services or health care will be the health care setting, the defendant's status as a doctor or health care provider, or both. So even though we don't get there, even if there is this rebuttable presumption, it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to bring forth all this evidence to show that we've rebutted this presumption. Instead, the court later goes on in that case to state that the statute does not similarly limit what a trial court may consider when the question is whether a claim is subject to the TMLA's expert report requirements. Thus, when making the determination, courts should consider the entire court record, including the pleadings, the motion and responses, and any relevant evidence properly admitted. There was no evidence admitted by appellant. He didn't attach any evidence to his motion. He didn't put forth or offer any evidence during the actual hearing on the motion to dismiss. Instead, he relied upon his belief that those first two prongs are met, so it's our burden now to overcome that presumption. But we don't even get there. But even if we do, which we clearly dispute that we do, the third prong, which I had mentioned before, states that the defendant's act, omission, or other departure from accepted standards must proximately cause injury or death to the claimant. Counsel had stated, but for Dr. Brill's finding her competent, his conduct, she would not have suffered damages. Well, this would have occurred whether he had diagnosed her as competent or not. Instead, we have two separate doctors who performed neurological testing. That doesn't matter. There is no the cause, the actual injury suffered by Jeannie Stokes would have happened regardless of whether Dr. Brazil was involved or not, regardless of whether he was a doctor or not. Instead, what we've said is, hey, he helped out. He took steps to protect the participants in this scheme, and his participation in that is what we've asserted claims against him for.
Now, understanding the broad definition of injury that's been applied both in the statute and in the case law, those would have occurred without regard to what Dr. Brazel did, how can his actions be a proximate cause of any damages?
Because his actions and what he did furthered that later on. So what he did is he's taken steps which he can't be immune from liability just because he was a doctor for her at some point.
No, I'm talking about your statement that these acts would have occurred without regard to whether he had diagnosed her as competent or incompetent, because the natural course of events were that she was doing these acts that caused her to suffer damages for which the petition seeks recovery, without regard to Dr. Brazel's determination that she was competent, if he declared her incompetent, it would have been different. But with his having stated that she's competent and restated that at a later time in a letter, if those things happen without regard to that conduct on the part of the doctor, how do you still get to the point that his actions were the cause of her injury?
Sure, and thank you, Your Honor. And let me clarify. He was a contributing factor to those damages. Obviously, he took steps to protect those participants in this scheme. But I may have spoken a little bit out. The doctors themselves, Dr. Sabine and Dr. John, both formally stated or diagnosed her as competent. Those are the diagnoses that, if we were alleging claims against them, would be covered as healthcare liability claims because they relate to the actual diagnosis. Here we haven't asserted any claims related to his diagnosis or the negligence in his care for her. Instead, what we've said is that these damages are solely economic damages for these transactions that these defendants got her to enter into, and Dr. Brazil was a willing participant in this. So certainly he's a contributing factor, but he's not the but-for cause. But for his conduct, this wouldn't have happened.
Your position in court is that the findings of competency by the doctors to whom Brazil referred her for definite diagnosis and analysis and testing, those were wrong also.
Well, if we
Well, she wasn't competent.
Right. We've asserted that she wasn't competent, that she lacked the capacity to enter into these execution. The execution of these documents. She was found totally incapacitated in 2009. Obviously, day one, day two, you're totally incapacitated. Usually, it's a gradual process, and we've alleged that this was occurring way back when. And whether she was competent or not, he didn't make any formal testing, or he didn't do any formal testing, make any formal conclusions about that. Instead, he sent them out to other doctors for those testing. And one of the things that counsel for appellant had argued is that you can't write in the term physical and injury. And the case, which Your Honor alluded to, was the Kaufman case, which was decided in 2011, which had a couple cases that it cited talking about where there were courts that had found that that economic damages, solely economic damages, could be a healthcare liability claim. Well, in my brief, I cited a case out of the Court of Appeals in Austin, which was just taken up by the Supreme Court last year, which that case specifically stated and went very well, I might add, went through the legislative intent of the Texas Medical Liability Act and its predecessor, and going through this determined that the whole purpose of Chapter 74 was designated to eliminate frivolous medical negligence claims deemed responsible for increasing medical malpractice insurance premiums to unacceptable levels. And in their view, in the court's view, the Court of Appeals in Austin, for a cause of action to be a healthcare liability claim within the purview of the TMLA, the injury that proximately results from the alleged wrongful conduct must involve more than simply economic harm. Rather, it must also involve some type of personal injury. Now, in going through not only the history of the Texas Medical Liability Act, but also in the Medical Liability Act as it exists now, in defining terms of claimant and looking at to other provisions of it, the court, this was the court's conclusion and holding, which I think makes sense because the Texas Medical Liability Act was designed to set rules and regulations for medical malpractice or liability claims, medical negligence claims.
Excuse me, what's the style of that case?
Yes, it is. The Court of Appeals case in Austin is PM Management Trinity NC LLC v. Kumetz, and that is 368 Southwest 3rd, 711.
Thank you.
And the Supreme Court took it up last year, and they actually addressed in providing the procedural posture that the appellate court had found this, that it involves something more than economic loss. It has to be a physical personal injury. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court didn't go any more detail on that. Instead, they found that in this case, some of the claims were healthcare liability claims. The other ones were not dismissed as healthcare liability claims. The appeal was on those. The Supreme Court said, well, you can't split up the claims. If they all relate to the same facts, they're all healthcare liability claims. You can't splice claims as healthcare or not healthcare when they all relate to the same facts. So unfortunately, they didn't address that, but they did state that the Court of Appeals had found that and didn't provide any dicta otherwise as far as that being incorrect. So our position is that we have here solely economic loss. We've asserted damages based on these transactions that she entered into at a time when she was influenced to do so and lacked the requisite capacity, and that's the injury she suffered. It doesn't relate to the course and scope of treatment. These acts that Dr. Brazil actually did were not just during treatment, but after treatment. And that the Kaufman case, which I wanted to show Your Honors, is that there's a statement which is not disputed in any healthcare liability claim that, the statute does not mandate that the injury itself occur during the patient's medical care or treatment, just that it be directly related to acts that occurred during the patient's healthcare or medical treatment. We've got an act a year and a half after medical treatment ended that we're complaining about. In 2010, a year and a half after he ceased being her doctor, an injury that is occurring then is based on an act that is happening then. Not an act that is happening during the course of treatment, but an act outside and after the treatment, which clearly is not within the reach of the bounds of Chapter 74, which is that is the clear basis of the statute and on case law that the injury itself has to be directly related to acts that occurred during the patient's health care medical treatment. And just briefly, I wanted to address the attorney's fees issue. I think the case law is clear. Even if assuming, which we obviously dispute, that this were to be found a healthcare liability claim, that the proper way to dispose of it would be to remand it to the trial court, who obviously didn't have an opportunity to hear the evidence on the attorney's fees and decide that issue. But we don't even get there. I think this is clearly not a healthcare liability claim. For that reason, based on the two components that I talked about, two essential elements that have to be met, that this was properly decided and that the trial court did not err.
Mr. Harville, I don't recall the doctor's name, but you did supplement your interrogatory response and add an additional doctor to testify about competency. What's the doctor's name?
It's Dr. Lisa Clayton.
Clayton, that's right, Dr. Clayton. Did Dr. Clayton ever examine Ms. Stokes?
She did.
Ever conduct a diagnostic test in terms of the kind of test that the other two doctors that were referred, that Dr. Brasser referred her to, conducted?
I'm not sure as far as the actual requirements and what she did on her testing, but yes, she did, and she found her to be totally incapacitated in 2009. The designation, and I had a feeling that you would ask me this question, is that the designation itself of a medical expert is not for the purposes of showing that here's the standard of care, here's the duty that was allegedly breached, this is where you should have been, and this is where you ended up, and that because of that you breached the standard of care. The medical expert has been designated for the purposes of opining on the Jeannie M. Stokes's mental capacity at the time these transactions were entered into. Now, one of the deciding or a very big factor in determining whether something is a healthcare liability claim under that second prong is the need for medical expert testimony. This is a case that doesn't need medical expert testimony for the purposes of showing that there was a duty and that this is where his conduct was and it fell below that duty and therefore he breached it and was negligent. That's not the purposes of the medical expert designation. The purpose of the medical designation is simply to opine on her capacity at the time of these transactions.
In her opinion, Dr. Clayton's opinion, she has a written opinion. Is that part of the record?
I do not believe it's part of the, it's not part of this record, no, Your Honor.
I don't remember seeing it, but at any rate, in her opinion, if she's given one, does she opine that the onset of incapacity was earlier than 2009?
Yes, Your Honor, she does. And in fact, it existed in 2007, and I think if I remember correctly, it even existed in 2006 and possibly earlier as well. But she hasn't. I don't believe she's done a formal report. And in fact, obviously, an expert report is not needed unless this is a healthcare liability claim. But for the purposes of just a report through depositions for an expert, I don't believe she's done a report.
So the conflicting, dueling expert opinions would be three doctors saying she was competent and one doctor saying she's incompetent at this stage of things.
Well, yes, you have two doctors who did formal testing, one doctor who may have been her general practitioner or family doctor. But it would be the extent of looking at medical records from all the doctors, and she's done so, and she's determined that she did not have the mental capacity to enter into these execution of these documents back in 2007.
I read your briefs carefully. And I understand your position about the issue of there being evidence presented and what happened and didn't happen in the trial court. However, what would be your appraisal of the circumstance were this case to be remanded to the trial court for the purpose of conducting a hearing and determining whether or not an expert opinion was required in this case, because if that happened, then the trial court might. Of course, this is an absence of an opinion and a failure to file and not a modification. So your legal position would be, what would be your legal position on that matter?
Well, the appellant never presented any evidence attached with his motion, never presented any evidence or made any offer with the trial court. And once the trial court denied, hey, I have an offer of proof, let's get this up for appeal, it's going to be reviewed de novo, so we all have this evidence to look at. Even in looking at the evidence, the result is the same. You look at the evidence, you look at Dr. Brazil's testimony, you look at the letter of this to the state bar that is in the record, which is one of our main pieces of evidence to show that these acts occurred outside of the course and scope of treatment. They, in fact, they occurred after treatment was ended. I don't think, even if it's remanded, the result is the same.
Facts are all in the bill of review is what you're saying.
Well, the facts were maybe not all the evidence, but I think that all the evidence that's determinative is in the record for the court, and I think that even if the court had considered that evidence, which I don't think they need to, the court needed to, because the case law is clear that the statute doesn't limit what a trial court can consider or this court can consider whether the claim is subject to the TMLA's expert report requirements. So when the court makes its determination, it reviews the entire record. I think in reviewing the entire record, it's clear these are not health care liability claims.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Harvell. Mr. Leonard, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be brief. Once again, as you were listening to Ms. Roberts' counsel statements, they still go back to capacity. She did not have capacity when actions were taken. The determination of whether or not somebody has capacity is done with only medical reviews, especially with the amount of medical review that's done in this case. They have stated that it's not related to any basis of physical or mental actions. Their claims are, so they're not going to have expert testimony to prove their claims. However, the case is cited in our brief state that even if you're not going to have expert testimony to prove your damages, as a procedural matter, you have to have an expert report prior within the 120 days. If that's not done, the amounts or the matter still dismissed. And they're looking at various cases such as a person was put into she was in a wheelchair. The wheelchair was put into the ambulance. The ambulance was taking her home. They had an accident or something on the way. She broke loose from her wheelchair where it was put and was injured. She argued, this is a simple negligence case. Did they put me in there right? I'm not seeking any medical help. I'm done with it. I've already received it. I'm going home. The court held that no, that was a medical liability case because the actions were involved with or related to the help that she had come to this facility to receive. In this case, it's similar to that. I mean, they're saying that Dr. Brazel somehow was not a doctor when her doctor providing her with aid when he was talking to someone else. Now, as you know, there would be a dispute of facts, but part about it is that Dr. Brazel only acted as her doctor. Whether or not he was supposed to have spoken with other people is whether or not there's a standard of the care and duty of disclosure, whether or not that was breached. That's where they have to come in with expert testimony. Now, if they're going to say, We only need to prove the value of the property that was stolen for our damages. That's fine, but you still have to get that first hurdle in before you can get there and have the suit and have damages. As I said, the cases have held that it's not whether or not you need the testimony for expert damages or for damages. It's whether or not this is a health care related claim. And everything's revolved around whether or not she was competent or incompetent, whether or not he disclosed or disclosed information that should have been disclosed. All of that relates to the health care and the continuing duty of whether or not somebody is supposed to keep information, privileged information, silent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leonard. Thank you, Mr. Harvell. And Mr. Spencer, we appreciate you being here. We appreciate also your arguments and your briefing for today's submission. Your case is submitted, and you all are now excused. We will proceed to the next case on our docket.